Patrick Timpone, Andrew Goss, and the Real World Money. So today, over the years...
Wait, that was piece of meat number one. Don't you want number two?
Oh, you had two pieces.
I did.
I didn't know. I saw
two was the best one of all.
Okay.
The best one. So Operation Paperclip involved the American intelligence community recruiting high-ranking members of the Nazi regime and bringing them to the United States and debriefing them. Great book, Gestapo Chief Heinrich Mueller was debriefed by the CIA Gestapo chief, and he told them, hey, that wasn't Hitler that died in that bunker. That was a body double, and he escaped. He went to South America. And so the FBI, of course, is looking all over for him. And another agent of Operation Paperclip comes to the FBI and says, hey, guys, Hitler's in South America. I know he's down there. I saw him. And so they said, yeah, prove it. And so the guy goes down to South America, takes a picture of him and Hitler, dates it and writes it on the back, and comes back to the United States and hands it all over to the CIA, where he is, what he's doing, et cetera, and so forth.
It was really him.
Well, the thing that was curious to me is that the notations in the file were, well, 10 years since the war, we can't prosecute him for war crimes anymore, so let's leave this alone. And that's what they did. So according to this... a former SS officer who is now an agent of American intelligence, Hitler was alive and well in South America. And they do know, of course, all the evidence attaches that two planes took off from Berlin before the body double was assassinated. And the Russians, of course, claim 20 years later, 65. Well, look, we've got the body of Hitler. We didn't tell you then, but we're going to tell you now. And so here's the skull fragment, here's the bullet hole, here's the dental records. They all match. And everybody leaves it alone. That's right, case dismissed. And I think the CIA was complicit in that because Operation Paperclip required them to keep everything kind of under wraps. And it was quid pro quo, in my opinion. Hey, we'll let you live. Don't say anything. We're going to take all your scientists, our entire rocket program, our weaponry, everything we took from the Nazis, from the Germans. And so in 2009, here comes a biologist who goes to the Russians and says, hey, I'd like to examine this skull. And he looks at the skull and pulls a fragment and does a DNA test. Lo and behold, the skull fragment is from a woman in her 40s, never even a male, let alone Adolf Hitler. So to me, those were the two most critical pieces of information. And why are we releasing a photograph of Adolf Hitler from 1954 in the Kennedy assassination?
Yeah, why indeed?
That's right. I'm like, how does this make sense? But whatever the logic is, I have the picture. And I have the documents from the CIA. So it seems to me that the CIA knew in 1954 that Adolf Hitler was alive, living under an assumed name in South America, and they did nothing about it.
Well,
got to admit, that's pretty meaty stuff.
That's pretty meaty.
I would have read that in the National Enquirer 30 years ago.
I think I'm going to see it at the supermarket shelves.
I think I did see it in the National Enquirer.
That's right. Probably did. So this term globalist and nationalist is... pretty interesting.
Yes.
And I think we
John McCain, globalist.
Yeah, let's just go into that a minute because...
Lindsey Graham, globalist.
So I was kind of thinking about who the globalists are, and you add some numbers, some people to this, but what is it fair to say, and these are people that we have affectionately termed the boys over the years, right? Somehow they got to term the boys.
Yes, but the American public has them separated as D's and R's. And you know how from the beginning of this show, I call them the Demopublicans and the Republicrats. There is no difference between the two. Their alliance is not to their party as it is to the people that what the church committee called the shadow government, the real government behind the government.
So would this be people like the military-industrial complex, big
that
pharma?
That Ike warned us about? Yeah,
big pharma in conjunction with the FDA and the USDA, this whole pharmaceutical thing, all the whole, these people are part and parcel of that, and they own all the media, correct?
Correct.
I mean, so the same people own the media. So then the boys or the globalists, they're not necessarily all liberal, like some people put out that the media is liberal. It just turns out that that's the way the worm is turned this time around. Would that be fair?
No? Yeah. Well,
in other words,
without being insulting to the globalists, they believe that the world's economy and the world's social standing should be performed by a centralized government authority.
Oh, so that's pretty left.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean,
yeah,
you know, they don't see that as bad. They see it as good.
Okay.
You know, he did that in his book. A very famous Rockefeller quote. It's something like, "We're grateful to the New York Times, Time Magazine, and the Washington Post." And he named a handful of newspapers. He said, and other great publications, who have. And this was the Council on Foreign Relations, CFR.
Yeah.
And he said that they've attended our meetings and given their discretion for nearly 40 years. And it would have been nearly impossible for us to hatch our plan for the world. I don't think he said hatch. I'm paraphrasing here.
Sure.
If we were subject to the light of publicity. And so then at the end of this whole statement, he begins by saying he's grateful and he thanks them. And then when he gets to the end, he says, if that's the charge, then I stand guilty as accused and I'm proud of it. That he said, characterizing me and my family as globalists and saying that we're conspiring with others to build a more global political and economic structure, one world, if you will. And that's his last, if that's the charge. I stand guilty, and I'm proud of it. Now, this would be okay if somebody else had said, David Rockefeller said this. But this is out of his memoirs. It's from his memoirs, for goodness sake. So, I don't know.
So, these people really believe this.
Yeah, it's not malicious.
No, this secret handshake thing. And
yeah, they're not doing it. What did Bill Clinton call them? Benevolent. They're dictators, but benevolent dictators. So they're not doing it with a mind towards evil. They honestly believe that the world would be better off if there was a United Nations that did all the legislation for the world and managed the economic affairs of the world. We wouldn't have any of these chunks and booms, you know.
Yeah.
It would be a steady playing field. Wouldn't have war. Foreign policy and economic policy should all be done on a globalist scale. And in fact, it was David Rockefeller who donated the land on the East River there in New York that the UN was built on, and he funded most of the construction. So what the right, the ultra-right, refers to as the globalist agenda is basically a plan to bring the entire Earth under the control of a single global entity that does all legislation. So that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But
these would be the same people, wouldn't they, Andrew, that love war and profit from war?
Mm.
So would they?
Yes and no.
Oh, because I'm wondering why there's against Trump, because he's really a hawk, and you know, they must love that.
Yeah.
If they love war, they must love Donald Trump because he's a hawk.
Well,
no way around it.
No, yeah.
Huh?
I don't think you can boil it down that simply.
Okay.
Although it was Ike that warned us, and this was right at his time.
The military-industrial complex.
The military-industrial complex, exactly.
Right.
And then Kennedy did a wonderful speech on
secret societies.
Yes.
Yeah, great speech.
Yeah, the
one. You can Google that one, folks.
I think that's the one that got him waxed.
Yeah,
but
secret society.
Here he
speech,
was effectively talking to America's newspaper men. And saying to them, look, we need your help. We need you to expose this the secret society.
Deep state, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Shadow government.
The idea that, you know, this entity is operating within our democracy, you did call it that, and they're attempting to undermine us in favor of a world political order.
Mm-hmm.
And to be fair, I mean, the when we were taught about globalism in school, I remember clearly the teacher explaining that what we wanted to do was raise the standard of living of everyone else in the world, that we had it so good here in the United States that we wanted to export that goodness all around the world. And that was the goal of the Peace Corps and of, you know, things of that nature. So, and the Red Cross, and well, the list is endless of us attempting to spread democracy around the globe with the feeling that if everyone was in the same boat, we'd all be better off. And I tended to agree with it, but because the teacher left out the critical point that in order to raise their standard of living, we would have to reduce ours. Now, the globalist agenda, no doubt about it, has gutted the American working class, the middle class, but it's created a separate middle class in Asia. You have the rise of the Chinese and their productivity state based upon taking from the American working class over the last 40 years and giving over to a new middle class, working class in Asia. But the one thing they're lacking is constitutional rights. You know, the thing that makes us free-thinking Americans, well, they don't have free-thinking Chinese. You know, they have Chinese, and they have their revenue stream and the things that they enrich themselves from the Chinese, from the globalist agenda. And, you know, throw Indonesia in there and Vietnam and every other country that's been so exploited. And you have a revenue stream without the uppity American right-seeking working class.
But you separate it in some way. You say that forks, like Bitcoin, they had a fork or didn't happen.
Yeah.
That there's a fork there with the military-industrial complex somewhere along the line, you think?
Yes, there is, yeah. There are those that said, okay, well, the globalist agenda fits well with what we want to do.
Yeah.
You know, because as you got to go in and stomp each one of these dictators that refuses to go along with the program, you got to take them out.
Gaddafi, all Saddam Hussein.
Yeah. Mogadesh, the Sandinistas. The list is endless of where the CIA has gone in, starting at around that same time, right, in the early 1950s.
Sure.
Gone into countries where there's going to be a political
Castro.
Leader there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's a long list. And we're going to upset and defeat these folks and put folks in that will follow our way of thinking. So they started sticking globalists in all around the world.
Pinochet.
Go ahead, continue.
Oh, the Shah of Iran, that classic one.
Well, Mogadesh, yeah, Mogadesh.
So there is a huge report from Brown University, the Watson Institute, and they said that they could track 5.6 trillion that has been spent on wars since 9/11. 5.6 trillion.
Well, the war on terror.
Yeah, the war on terror, right?
Yeah.
And this was, of course, way back the day before 9/11, when Rumsfeld said, you know, we got
a few trillion bucks we can't account for.
$2.3 trillion we can't account for. He said this the day before 9/11.
That's right.
How can you lose 2.3 trillion of anything?
Well, bad accounting is all that was.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I think it was that software we had. 2.3 trillion. So,
and disparate technology. I mean, even today, if a tech guy goes into government and looks at our operations with our old monochrome screens and antique software based on Fox Pro, they have to laugh. I mean, they can't help themselves. A government's computer systems are so antiquated and they don't integrate well that many believe, and I'm one of them, that the $2.3 trillion loss is not people taking $2.3 trillion in a suitcase and running away with it. It's poor accounting. It's like when you have so much money, other people's money, in this case taxpayers' money, the last thing you worry about is justifying or keeping track of.
You mean the $500 toilet seats, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah. And of course, exactly. The Boeings and all the military industrial complex. They, that's
and the Northrop Grumman.
And
the Glomar. You know, this was, think about
the Halliburtons.
The Halliburtons. Yeah. When that Russian sub sank, many suggest it was 400 miles off the coast of Hawaii. A Russian sub sank, and it had geared up 3 missiles in its silo. And missile one, when they finally found the thing in 1967, there was one missile that had actually fired when the thing was submerged and stayed in its silo, and the exhaust gas blew out the submarine and it sank. But when they found it, it actually had the third missile was armed and in launch position 400 miles from the coast of Hawaii.
When was this?
1967.
Okay.
1967.
So how did we get there from where we were? I kind of lost the transition.
We got there from where we were because we were in a Cold War mentality. And the Cold War was heated up right around that time when the CIA spent an enormous ton of money building for Howard Hughes the Glomar Explorer, which was allegedly a drilling ship. But it was, in fact, a $280 million attempt to retrieve the Russian submarine that sank 400 miles off the coast of
Hawaii.
That
was a lot of money back then.
Back then? Cool. Yeah, so they built this ship, gave it to Howard Hughes, and had him go out there as a cover and pretend to be drilling for oil, when in fact he was examining and trying to lift this submarine. And he actually got as far as getting it halfway out of the water. And that's where they discovered that it was ready to launch. Now, here's another reason why this is critical, the old false flag operation. I believe, and there are others that believe the same thing, that this Russian submarine could have shot a missile at Hawaii from 800 miles away. It didn't have to be 400 miles. Well, you know why? Because that's exactly the distance, the length of the Chinese submarines could actually launch a missile from 400 miles. So the attempt, in my belief, at the end of World War II, was to get the United States and China into a war, so that whoever was the weakest when that war was over, Russia could just finish them off.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. That's a pretty deep thinking.
Pretty wild, yeah. Kind of like that one. So
they were fighting the globalist agenda all the way back to the 1950s.
Yeah, if this Brown thing is anywhere close to being true, 5.6 trillion.
It is.
This doesn't all come out of Treasury. So this has got to be a lot of dark money through somehow the Fed and the CIA, or where does this money come from?
Of course it all comes out of the Treasury. It all comes out of the Treasury.
It doesn't
all come out of the...
It's not on the books, though.
Yeah, and this was another thing. I talked to a CIA operative many years ago who said to me, "You don't believe that $500 hammer stuff, do you?" I'm like, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you know, we say we spent $500 on a hammer, but we really bought a $10 hammer and spent $490 in a way that we don't want you to know."
Okay, that's how that works. All right.
That's just government waste. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's how that works.
It's just wasteful spending. So.
And so, but you look back on it and you say, what did the United States citizens, the people, gain from any of this stuff, from killing Gaddafi and killing Hussein,
blowing up
Iraq into boulders, you know, 15 years in Afghanistan. Are we safer? I mean,
No. You're
still dropping your drawers at the airport. I mean, what's going on? You know, this is just $1 trillion that, who made money off of this thing? The boys.
The globalists.
The globalists.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they love war. They got to, right?
Yeah.
They don't really believe this. I mean, didn't they create ISIS and train them to say?
Yep. Well, and now, today, we have the ultimate in fascism, right? We have the ultimate in fascism in that they're enlisting these multinational corporations to lay down the law to us backwards people. You know, for example, if you recall, Apple would not dare hack the iPhone for the FBI. You remember that?
I remember,
San Bernardino bomber. But yet this latest guy that was shooting up all those people in Las Vegas, Apple said, "Oh yeah, we'll hack that for you. Give it over. We'll hack that right away. No problem." So they use their position, these corporations. Starbucks saying, well, we're going to hire 50,000 immigrants. Oh, the hell with all those American veterans that are looking for jobs, but we're going to hire immigrants. So they try to shame us as citizens into doing the right thing.
Hmm.
I even heard this morning one of these globalist organizations has bought land along the Mexican border with the intent of preventing the construction of a wall by fighting the eminent domain claim that's ultimately going to hit them when Donald Trump decides he's going to build a wall through their land.
So what is the main things? Is it the tariffs and the wall that the globalists dislike about Trump?
Tariffs.
That's the
period.
Big deal, right?
That's the number one thing. Right. And they've talked that out of existence. And, of course, the wall is next. The idea that you're going to somehow impede the flow of exploitable labor from the Southern Hemisphere.
We don't want that.
No. We need the cheap workers that'll do the jobs, I'm using my air quotes now, that Americans won't do. The jobs that Americans don't want. These migrant workers come in here, many cases with fake Social Security numbers, make payments to the Social Security system.
Never get taken
that
out.
Right.
So believe me, I went through that with my company.
They're very profitable. Yeah, very profitable.
Yeah, they got these fake Social Security numbers and they pay in.
They don't care.
No, they just want to work.
They just want to work. It's all they want. So if that's the cost of working, well, then they'll pay it and never file a claim. Now, granted, they've gotten a lot more sophisticated with the help that they're being given by these organizations who'll say, oh, come in here. We'll show you how to get the food stamps, how to register your car illegally, how to get insurance. You know, there's a handful of states where you don't need a Social Security number to register your car, North Carolina being one of them.
Wow.
Go to North Carolina, buy a car, register it, get a driver's license, then go wherever you want to go in this country. And so all of these little loopholes, how to get food stamps, how to register to vote, even though you're not entitled to vote, you know, all these sorts of things are instructed. They're schooled in these disciplines by folks in organizations that would prefer a one world, a single world with one world government, one world money, one world regulations, and all of it controlled by them. So it's a noble goal. I just don't know that it's best for America.
So that's one of the reasons why they spend all the time on all the media outlets.
The first thing they buy. You go back to the founding of the Republic, and the battles, the pen battles between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson and his crowd, working as Publius, I think, was one of the pseudonyms, and they were just back and forth in the newspapers. You know, one guy laying out the case for a globalist type of an organization and another knocking it. We can't do this. So the buying of the newspapers and the influencing of public opinion. In fact, many would argue, I would tend to agree, that probably the biggest written word that influenced Americans during the Revolution was the Thomas Paine pamphlet, Common Sense.
Common Sense, right.
Right. And so Common Sense, of course, no one bothers to notice that Thomas Paine was a communist. You know, he was an early socialist. He was the first one that advocated for this idea of a universal income, that the lands that the government had should be used to support those less fortunate in our society.
I think he reincarnated as Zuckerberg.
I think he may have, yeah. So, at any rate, these globalists, loosely linked as they may be, all work towards a common agenda, which is no borders,
Terrorists.
No sovereignty.
What else do they dislike about the president? I guess this whole thing that he wants more competition, between pharmaceutical companies, they hate that, right?
Oh, they hate competition.
They hate competition.
Damn the word. That's J.P. Morgan. Yeah. He hated the word competition. So, anyway.
Boy, they're powerful dudes, man. They got
U.S. Steel.
They got every radio television station hammered in. Don't lock
94% of all the media is owned by six corporations.
Just locked in, boy.
Yeah.
And then Hollywood too.
Well, sure, that was their
whole thing. Early on, right? They were in Hollywood.
Joe Kennedy went into Hollywood and took over quite a bit way back then. And then, you know, following him, of course, the CIA recognized immediately the benefit. And Walt Disney Company, in fact, was utilized pre-World War II. In 1939, in fact, the first withholding tax from your paycheck, the idea that government was just going to take theirs.
And
the
who
day
did they
you
use to tell people about
Donald
it?
Duck.
Donald Duck. Unbelievable.
Duck explained it. Yeah. And so this was a two-year emergency measure that's allowed in the Constitution. The Constitution says in a time of war, the government can tax anything at all, including your income and your money. Just tax your money. How much money you have, you owe us a tax, a direct
emergency
tax.
Only.
Only an emergency, only for a period of 2 years. And so when this law expired in 1941, they didn't use Donald Duck to tell us then. They just kind of let it expire and didn't
just
tell
kept
him.
Going. Just kept
and
going.
We've had a voluntary tax system ever since.
It really is voluntary.
Well, yeah.
Of course, if you don't volunteer, you get in trouble.
Well, that's the way it is in the Army, too. Yeah, isn't it? We're looking for volunteers.
And then here, do this.
And you're not going to volunteer? Okay, here, we'll volunteer for you.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take a break.
Awesome health can no longer be attained from food alone. Since the advent of chemical agriculture in 1945, U.S. soils have become progressively more demineralized and infertile. Human health has correspondingly declined. To reverse this trend and to even have a chance at feeling great requires sophisticated supplementation to make up for what is not in our foods. When our bodies are mineral deficient, they require more protein. We suggest you begin with One World Whey. One World Whey is a new and improved protein power food. Our technological enhancement yields us a whey protein that produces phenomenal results. All case histories indicate that your body functions in a more youthful manner. One World Whey not only supports detoxification, building of lean muscle, and immunity, it strongly supports your energy and sense of well-being. One World Whey tastes delicious and comes in single servings. You can click on the One World Whey banner ad and order right here at OneRadioNetwork.com. That's OneRadioNetwork.com.
Previously with chemist, biologist, and nutritionist George Altgeld, we asked him this. And so what do you think about Dr. Seneff's contention that as these glyphosates are in the soil, they bust the sulfur cycle, and that's really detrimental to the body?
It's extremely detrimental. Sulfur is such an important detoxifying agent for the entire body and especially for the liver. You've got to have trace minerals so that the liver can build these compounds that are essential for getting itself cleaned. And that lady who was talking about sulfur, man, play that ad every chance you get, because our foods are so deficient in sulfur, and it is a big deal for the liver to have enough sulfur to make all those compounds that it uses to detoxify itself. Not just sulfur, they're all important, but sulfur is the one that we're so deficient in, and we need sulfur.
Thanks, George. I had some this morning. You might want to give it a try. You can click an order right on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com. 3 locations, 3 prices delivered. And if you like more than 4 pounds for a discount, email me, Patrick, at OneRadioNetwork.com. Andrew Goss is our guest every Wednesday. He buys and sells gold coins for a living. He also sponsors the show, and we appreciate that. He's been supporting us for 10 years now. Yesterday, I heard I was going into Austin, and I heard an ad on the radio from a gold supplier. He was selling. I don't know what they were selling. They generally, I guess, they're selling
fear.
Fear. That was the main point. It was fear point, like you foreign. It was very well done, very well done. But the whole thing was that this whole thing is going to blow up any day, and if you don't have gold and silver in your portfolio, you know, you're going to die. But what are they selling, these people in late night TV that I don't have, compared to what you offer?
Well, they're selling something that they can get a lot of. That's the real key for those mass media campaigns. For me, on any given day, I sell a rare coin, and if somebody said to me, okay, I'll take 2 of those, that's it. It's over. There's only one. And one available now. And if I get another one, I'll call and offer it to you. But for right now, I only have this one. And so that's really the difference between us and other rare coins.
So you're a whole whole other animal, a whole different genre.
That's right.
From these people that are doing Krugerrands and Mid-State stuff.
I bought an 1854 proof $3 gold piece this week. It's still at the grading service. I anticipated to grade a proof 62 on a scale of 1 to 70. I paid, what did I pay for that? $64,000.
Go, boy.
One of 14 made. So,
go, man.
One of 14.
$64,000 for a coin?
Yeah.
I
laid it out. Man. And you know, it's one of 14 made, maybe one of five that survive, two of which are impounded in museum collections. So net three. There's three coins available for the world.
Hmm.
That's, for me, I mean, that's an extreme example.
Of course, that's on your high end.
That's on the very high end. The bulk of the coins we sell are priced at like $3,000 to $5,000. And it has nothing to do with the gold content, nothing to do with the silver content. Heck, I bought a penny last week also for $2,800.
Good for you.
It was a 1909 S.
VBD.
VDB.
I remember when we were kids, we were looking for those.
But this one was red, Patrick, like the day it was made. And on a scale of 1 to 70, I graded a 65.
And how much you pay for it?
$2,800.
You know, it's so funny. Let me do a quick story, and I'll let you continue. When we were kids, we had these little boo books, right? What do they call these things?
Whitman books.
Whitman books. And you open them up, and you had about, three pages, Andrew?
That's right.
Folded out of different things, like nickels and dimes and pennies and quarters.
Pennies were the big
ones. And you could get this stuff because you went to the drugstore and you got change, and it was like real money.
You picked through your pennies.
And we always... That was the number one thing that nobody had was a 1909 SVBD. I'll remember to this day.
That's right. And the 14D.
On the 14D.
And the 14D.
But you
and
couldn't find those. Yeah, couldn't.
People were taking 1919 coins and replacing the one with a zero. So,
that's,
you know, counterfeiting went on even in those.
So if I would have had one, you would have given me $2,800 for it today.
Today? Yeah. I remember in those days, though, you could buy a nice red 09S VDB for around $70.
Oh, you mean if we would have been smart enough to go out and buy one, which we weren't, because who would know?
I did.
But you were a geek, man.
I
was just a kid collecting stuff in pinball machines. You know, I didn't know. So I could have actually purchased one for $70.
That's right.
Of course, that was 50 years ago.
But then you had to keep it nice for 50 years.
Yeah, no way.
And there were no slabs then. You know, when we sell a coin today, we send them to NGC, which is where this penny is. I sent it to NGC because I'm not going to ask my customer, hey, you don't know anything about coins. Take my word for it. This is a rare coin, and it's worth $3,000, because I'm not selling it for $2,800, obviously. So maybe I'm asking $3,500. Who knows? We'll see when it gets back what grade it grades.
Oh, wow.
But point is, they're secure in these slabs. They're independently certified, not by this company.
Slabs, which are pieces of plastic.
Big
right?
piece of plastic entombs
the coin.
You
can't even open them up,
Well, you shouldn't.
You can, but you
shouldn't.
Right.
As long as you keep it in that slab, then it's protected. Hmm. It'll stay without getting nicks and scratches and wear on it, and it will maintain its grade and hence its value. If you buy a real rare coin like this and you abuse it, let the dog play with it, let the kids play with it, it loses its value, its luster, and its substance.
Okay, if one of our listeners saying, well, this sounds interesting, and I understand inflation, and maybe gold and silver are going to be more...
This is copper.
Yeah, copper, or maybe this real money stuff is going to be worth more money years from now.
Mm-hmm,
but why would it be better, say, if they had $2,000 to spend, why would it be better, or $3,000, to buy, say, a coin worth $2,500 from you, like a St. Gaudens, rather than just go out and spend $2,500 on a mint coin, you know, from the mint or a Krugerrand? What would be the advantage?
Well, with Krugerrand or a Maple Leaf or American Eagle or any of the 1 ounce bullion gold coins.
Which they sell all the time.
All over the place.
They're making them
every day, and you can find them on eBay. You can find them at your local dealer. You see them on TV. They make them by the millions, tens of millions. They strike these
coins.
But
it's real gold.
Well, sure, it's gold.
Okay.
But there's only one way to make money with that coin.
When gold and silver goes up.
That's it. There's no other way to make any money at all.
If gold and silver goes down?
Well, they go down. There's no other value to these things. I don't care what the grade is, because the mint is striking them with the state of the art, and they are cranking out perfect coins. Mint state 70s. Perfect. Can't be any better. Not a mark on them. Full strike. Full luster. Perfect coins. By the millions. By the tens of millions. So whether you have a perfect coin or not doesn't matter. But you think the marketers tell you that? No, no. They go ahead and put these bullion coins in the slab and grade them MS-70 and then say to you, it's perfect. Okay, so who cares? No one. At the end of the day,
no one. That's a problem.
It's an ounce of gold.
Because everybody's got one. It's just
that's
an ounce
right.
of gold.
It's,
a,
it's
and
just
then what
an
do you
ounce
pay
of gold.
For like a gold? Like gold is $12.78 today. What would you pay for just an ounce of a coin like that from these people?
Well, if you're careful and you shop
yeah.
and you do the best job that you possibly can, I've seen them delivered as low as 5% over the spot price of gold delivered. Probably going to have to buy quite a few to get them that cheap.
So, like, you're talking still
$13.50.
Yeah, $13.50. Yeah.
Right. And, but again, only one way to make money. Gold goes up. They go up.
But you have said that there's a pretty good chance in the next 5-10 years gold
yeah.
will be higher.
Great chance.
So it's not a dumb investment.
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, I mean, having good, nothing yeah. or having an eagle,
yeah.
you're, you know, having
yeah,
an eagle.
Having dollars and having an eagle.
That's no brain. I've even had people after learning about this say to me, well, Andy, can I trade my eagles for $20 gold pieces? Well, sure you can. But they're fine. I would advise you to get rid of your cash first. And when that's gone, when your investment cash is gone, then you want to use your eagles to trade. Go ahead.
But then back to the gardens, if you have one $2,500 coin and you paid $2,500, but gold is only $1,300.
Well, then you've got
$1,200 in the numismatic. So how do you...
Yeah, but you have a coin that's going to be on the high end of the scale. $2,500, that's a 65 grade.
Pretty maybe spicy little coin.
66 yeah. grade. You know, that's a 100-year-old coin that's on the top end of perfect, and it's been used as money. So how are you going to make money with that?
Yeah.
Both two ways.
Okay.
One, because of a fixed supply and increasing demand, the premium above gold increases along with the price of gold.
It keeps going up.
That's right. Mm. So not only do you make money when gold goes up, but you make money when it gains numismatic value.
What if it goes down in numismatic value?
Well, that's so
no,
odd.
No, it can't really.
And
can
not
it?
After this long.
No, after 100 you know, years, why would it go
yeah,
down?
Yeah, because the supply after 100 years is well known. It's not like there are hordes of them waiting to surface. These coins, for the most part, have been used and distributed or turned in during the gold recall. And anyway, the point is, there are two ways to make money with a numismatic coin. One is the increase in the price of gold. So if you bought both, you bought an American Eagle and you bought a Mint State 65 $20 gold piece, and the price of gold goes up $10. The price of the American Eagle is going to go up $10.
Right.
But the price of that rare $20 gold piece might go up $15 or $20 because the demand influences the supply. Unlike the American Eagle coin, where people if people just suddenly decide they're going to start buying eagles tomorrow, the mint makes more. But if somebody decides, well, we're going to all buy $20 gold pieces tomorrow, there are no more to make. The only way you're going to get it is to pay a premium above the spot price of gold to the person that already owns it. That's the difference.
And you've said quite often in your career, which is kind of curious, that when the price of gold goes up, people,
the premium goes up.
Yeah, but so. People buy coins when it's like on the way up.
Popular delusions and the madness of crowds. Uh-huh. You know it. We saw it on this show when gold was 700, 800, 900. And I'm telling people, buy it, buy it. It's going up, buy it. It's going up every week. It was like a broken record. Then if you recall when it hit the peak at $1,900.
I remember.
Our listeners were calling us, telling us that it was going to $2,500. So the mentality
it's
of
it's a
folks,
Bitcoin kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
I know it's going to go up because
yeah.
it's at $1,900. My broker said it's going to $2,500.
That's right. So I'm going to buy it. Yeah, I'm going to buy it. Well, do you think you really it's wise? You haven't bought a coin in the last 10 years. You've not bought a single one.
Why would you buy one?
And now you're going to take all your money and buy it today? No, and I tried to talk people out of it in 2011. In fact, I gave that advice, and you could play back. That's the beautiful thing about your archives.
I remember.
Dollar average in. Don't put all your money in today. Buy a little today. Buy a little next week. Buy a little next month. Average your way in. The price may go up, but it may go down. And so by averaging your way in, you smooth out the bumps. And so many of my listeners said, yeah, but why would I buy later? I should buy it now. Let me just buy it now. I just Anyway.
What's that title? That madness?
Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds by McKay. Anybody who's investing in Bitcoin ought to read that book.
Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. I thought that was, the other person? It's McKay?
I thought so.
Okay. All right. If you'd like to talk, you have staff in Hilton Head and Jersey, right?
Oh, was this a commercial?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Well, then it was a commercial. I buy and sell gold and silver coins. That's what I do. So
was this a commercial?
Take my advice with a grain of salt.
Well,
take my advice from the perspective of someone who buys and sells and silver coins. Talk to your bond broker. See what kind of advice they're going to give you. Because they're on the opposite end of the spectrum. They don't think you should buy gold and silver coins. They think you should buy Chicago's municipal bonds. So at any rate, get both sides of the story. If you feel like I do and you want to learn more, Patrick's right. We have professional numismatists, people that will know the answers and that have studied coins for a long time. And it's their trade, their profession. They're not salesmen. They're numismatists.
No salesman will call.
No, salesmen just don't do well. Listen, it's easy to sell, but if you don't know what the heck you're selling, product knowledge is key, and no one tops my people in product knowledge. We ongoing training all the time, teaching each other what we know about numismatic coins, a lifelong study. And so you'll get seasoned numismatists that know the market, know the ins, know the outs, know the pitfalls, and will keep you out of them. It's easy. Call 800-468-2646. I'll give that number again, but you have to mention that you heard it on one radio network. I hate to say it that we discriminate, but we do. If you're a listener to one radio network, you will be treated with the utmost respect because we know that you know, having listened to the show. So call us at 1-800-468-2646 and begin your education. You've probably gotten a lot of it if you're a long-term listener to the show, but it's always good to read it, understand it. We have a two-page pamphlet that explains the pitfalls, something no other firm does. Like here's the downside of investing in coins. And we pride ourselves on education, and that's what we'll do. So if you want to learn before you buy, which is what you should do, not after you buy, then give us a call, 800-468-2646. Thank you, Patrick.
Oh, you're quite welcome. And not to pile on, but a quick story. A friend of mine was a chiropractor having a hard time trying to start a new business. And he needed some extra work, and he got a job selling gold and silver coins in a company in Houston. He just got a job. He was a chiropractor. He knew nothing about it. Nothing about it.
Yeah, and I know he was on the phone the next day.
The next day. And
talking to people.
I got on with a little whiteboard, and I said, well, let me at least explain somehow this goes to maybe help you in your job, you know, to help you sell. You know, I was trying to help him out because he was clueless. And they just hired him. They just hired him.
And, you know, a lot of these big firms, and I don't mean to knock them, but here's what they do. So the owners of the firm form a separate corporation. And then the separate corporation buys the coins at the real market value and then sells them to the phone corporation at a markup. And so now when your friend sees the coin coming in the door for the first time, and he sees the price of that coin, if he marks it up 10% and sells it to somebody in Iowa, he feels like, okay, I didn't really hurt anybody. But what he perhaps doesn't know is before the firm gets the coin, it's already been marked up 20%. And so this model, if you will, that's employed by most of the big trading houses throughout the country, starts out with a coin at a price that's already too high and then adds to it. So I've seen some real horror shows. This is, again, why I say to folks, learn before you buy. Many folks, the first exposure they're going to have to this market is that first cold phone call that they get from your friend with all of his or her enthusiasm bleeding over the phone and infecting the person on the other end. And it's well-meaning. There's nothing negative about it. But the price that the end user ends up paying A, they're getting the most common coins because that's what they need. If you got 100 people like this on the phone, you need the most common coins so you can have a lot of them. And unfortunately, by the time you buy the coin, it's been marked up so much that you're paying way over the market value, and it takes you years to get even. Now, to be fair, you will get even, no question, and you'll probably still make money. I used to say you could send a gorilla into a coin shop in 1975 and just buy random coins out of the case at full retail markup, and by 1980, you had already made money. So there are periods like that, and I do believe these companies prey on that. The great returns means that you can take advantage of folks going in and know that sooner or later they'll be well and whole again. I prefer to do it differently. For us, we put a modest markup on our coins, and we're completely vertically integrated, meaning there's no one here that makes money without working. So it's not that type of a firm. And if you want to do business with a firm like that, then please give us a call, 800-468-2646.
Previously, with a longtime friend, Phil Wilson, the exclusive distributor of the Relax Far Infrared Sauna.
I've been sweating and promoting the benefits of saunas and sweating for 16 years now. Can you believe it?
Wow, 16 years. Regularly that long?
20 minutes a day for about 15 years now.
6 months ago, man, I started doing it every day, and I don't think I've missed a day. How this has improved my life, I mean, I can't tell you. It's pretty amazing. I tell you what, I feel better and better. What's going on?
Well, the proof is definitely in the pudding. And if a person would go to YouTube and search for Relax Sauna Testimonials, they'll get 650 testimonies on what the Relax Sauna has done for different individuals, from feeling better to getting rid of extreme pain to getting rid of neuropathy to just helping a person feel more calm, alert, relaxed, tuned in, and everything else.
And everything else. These are really lovely units, extremely low EMFs. Email me, Patrick, at oneradionetwork.com, and I'll give you a deal on this sauna. We also have an option to get a relaxed heat lamp, but we'll work it out together. Email me, Patrick, at oneradionetwork.com. That's right, Patrick. And whether you want a heat lamp, a sauna, or both, or just I'll give you a deal. I've got the authorization. We can't put it in print because of the price. You know how that works, but I can give you a deal. Just email me, Patrick, at oneradionetwork.com. I told Phil I would like to take less commission and sell more saunas, so he worked this out with me, as long as I don't put it in print. And so when they say this is just for One Radio Network listeners, it is, because nobody else sees it unless you're hearing to this show. And Patrick at oneradionetwork.com.
Know the source on One Radio Network.
It's the Real World of Money with Andrew Goss. Once again, here's Patrick.
Well, Andrew, one of these days, surely our offstage announcer will mention you, but I don't know, she just never does. It's like, I don't know, you just need a PR person to help you out here. You ready to do some emails?
Well, before we do, I'd like to go back to the Federalist Papers.
Oh, the Federalist Papers?
Yeah.
Were we talking about those?
We were for a minute.
Okay, sure.
Okay, so the Constitution of the United States was proposed in, September 1787?
I remember, yeah, it was great.
Okay, so by the end of that month, the New York papers that were owned by the Hamilton crowd were already starting to see articles and public letters under the names like Publius, I mentioned,
yeah.
Brutus, and Cato. You know, these folks were pseudonyms for Hamilton and Madison. And there were 85 total articles that were written in support and in opposition. And the 85 articles are generally known as the Federalist Papers. Okay? And there are just a bunch of essays that appeared in the newspapers of the day. Now, of course, we know today that the people that were angling for the Constitution, the backers of Alexander Hamilton, they owned the newspapers. So it's very easy to see how the Independent Journal and the New York Packet and the Daily Advertiser, a handful of others, were running these letters to the editor and these essays that were touting and speaking against the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers. And I think Ralph Ketchum wrote a great book in the 80s, The Federalist and Anti-Federalist Debates. And Federalist number 10, Madison, this is probably the most famous of them, talks about democracy and the mob rule by the majority, and how we really didn't need it. And in Federalist 84, Hamilton says, oh, we don't need the Bill of Rights. There's provisions in the Constitution that protect liberty, and we don't need a Bill of Rights.
Hmm.
Please.
Good for him.
Good for him.
We put him on a $5 bill, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we raise him. We revere him as a hero. Wow. In my opinion, Alexander Hamilton was an agent of foreign influence that was sent to the United States for the sole purpose of insinuating himself into the proposition and of making sure that things went the way they wanted. Assumption of the state's debts was one of the things that they wanted to make sure, because many of the states were saying, oh, the heck, we're not going to pay our pre-British debts. So if you're a British creditor and someone in the U.S. owes you money, you're not getting paid. Hamilton's job was to, again, insinuate himself in there. And my favorite part of the story is the grand bargain. And many people say to me, how on earth did George Washington, the father of our country, the hero of America, how did he go along with the idea of a central bank?
Yes, how indeed?
How indeed? And you know the answer?
What?
Well, George Washington owned a lot of land just over the Potomac River in Virginia.
Oh.
And what Hamilton said to him was, look, I know those boys in Philadelphia want the capital there, and you know, Federal City in Pennsylvania was going to be the capital of the United States.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
But I can talk to my boys, Robert Morris and the crowd that controls him, and we could talk them out of insisting on this provision. In fact, what we'll do is we'll put the capital on your land.
Really?
In Virginia.
Really?
And we'll name it Washington, D.C.
Whoa.
If you'll give us this central bank.
Really?
That's the grand bargain.
Whoa.
And
how do you know this?
Because I read history.
Really?
You know, this
so old
dinner.
So George, he
sold out.
He sold out.
Yeah, he did. And, you know, for the rest of his life, he was a lot salesman. That's what he did. He sold lots in the new capital city, which happened to be on his land.
Whoa.
Yeah.
The rest of the story.
The rest of the story, as Paul Harvey loved to tell us. Yeah.
And that's a true story.
Well, it is. In fact, you can read it yourself if you read the words of Hamilton and how he pulled this off with the grand bargain. Him and Thomas Jefferson, who's also a Virginian, and George Washington.
Why did they need George, Andrew, to take this central bank deal?
He had to sign off as president.
Oh, that's right. So he had to sign off, yeah.
He said to Hamilton, look, give me your proposal for a central bank. And Hamilton gave it to him. Hmm. And then he said to Jefferson, tell me why you're against this. And so Jefferson wrote out this really well thought out, he wrote the Constitution.
Yeah,
so he knew the dangers of a central bank. So he wrote this well thought out argument against it. And George Washington promptly handed that argument to Alexander Hamilton and said, here, refute this. And Hamilton sat down and refuted it. And so then Washington went along with Hamilton's plan. Not to mention that all the congressmen and everyone of any significance was included as shareholders.
Oh, yeah. And so, in other words, the McCains of the day, the people with a lot
of... Oh, yes.
Yeah, those people were all
given stock.
Cut in on the deal. Wow.
Yeah, they were loaned money. Hmm. It's like, I know you don't have any money to buy these shares, but we'll loan you the money.
Oh, good.
And you can then take that money and buy the shares. And of course, they were wildly profitable. They made tons and tons of money. So Congress itself, we the people, were given 20%. And then the other 80% was divided first among Hamilton's benefactors, Philip Schuyler, Robert Morris, and people of this stature. And the rest of the 80% was handed out to congressmen. Here, congressmen, here's some shares in the First Bank of the United States. Hmm. And they made enormous amounts of money. by 1808, they simply said, oh, we'll sell the nation's shares. I'll keep mine, but the nation's shares, we'll sell those.
So this is how the boys eventually to this day own the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Give me the power to coin a nation's money, and I care not who makes its laws.
So what are the names that we know for people, new listeners?
Daniel Webster.
No, what are the corporations or the banks that own the Federal Reserve Bank of New York that monetizes debt?
I thought you were going to say, name me people that were
how about just
probably
some of the
most famous
the
Daniel
big players
Webster.
Now, the Fed.
J.P. Morgan Chase.
Chase, who? I know them.
Goldman Sachs.
Goldman Sachs, we know that.
Bank of America.
Bank of America.
Hong Kong Shanghai Bank Corporation.
HSBC.
Commercial Bank of China.
Hmm.
Deutsche Bank.
Deutsche Bank.
Union Bank of Switzerland.
Oh, our faves.
Hmm.
Now, is the Bank
Barclays.
Of, where does the Bank of England come in? Because they're still...
Barclays?
Oh, they're Barclays.
Barclays? Yeah, Barclays.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So these are the people that own
Royal
the
Bank of Scotland?
Yeah, Royal Bank. And that monetized the debt, actually creates currency. And
correct.
Yeah.
These are the people that profit from the $20 trillion national debt,
wow,
of which interest payments exceed $300 billion a year.
That's $300 billion a year.
With a B.
They're paying out to these people, right?
In interest.
In interest.
For money that belongs to the people.
That's crazy.
So it's like, okay, you just won the lottery. What did I win? Well, you won this magic checkbook. Well, explain the magic checkbook. Well, it's simple. You simply write checks, and then people accept them as money. You can buy anything you want. That's the sovereign power that every government has, the ability to create money. So what are we going to do with this magic checkbook? And so Alexander Hamilton raises his hand and says, I have a proposal.
I know what to do.
Give me the checkbook, and then I'll write the checks and loan it to you guys. What do you think?
Okay, we'll do it.
Yeah, that sounds like a good plan, Alex. Let's do that.
Jeez.
This guy's a hero. He's a traitor. And I believe Hamilton should be stripped from the money. He's on the $10 bill.
Oh, $10.
And replace him with Harriet Tubman or Madam C.J. Walker or Booker T. Washington
or Thomas Jefferson.
George Washington Carver. I get it. We don't have any black Americans on U.S. money. Wait a minute. Yes, we do. That's right. We have George Washington Carver on a half dollar struck in 1954. We have Booker T. Washington on a half dollar struck in 1946. In this racist country, America, we put two black men on our coins 60 years ago. So we are an enlightened country. I care not what everybody wants to say about how racist we are. In reality, we provide equal opportunity to all Americans. The idea that people around the world think they have a right to come to our country and enjoy the benefits of our birthright, I disagree with that. And I'm not a globalist, obviously. I'm white, for those of you who don't know, and I'm a nationalist. So I guess that makes me a white nationalist, which in this day and age will almost get you arrested. Huh.
So if you went out on the street and asked 100 people around the country, 10 people here, go to New York, San Francisco, out on the street.
We did that very
thing. And told them that instead of creating the money themselves when they go short cash, that they actually borrow the money from a private bank. How many people do you think would say, oh yeah, I knew that?
None.
Really?
In fact, we sent our roving reporter.
None?
Yeah.
They don't know it.
No, they do not. My good friend Tom DeSalvatore, his brother is a reporter.
Yeah.
And I engaged his brother several years ago.
That's right. You did.
Ago.
You went on the
sent
street.
Him into Times Square
right.
with a camera crew and had him ask people, hey, who do you think owns the Federal Reserve? It was funny. It was a funny bit. I should probably dig up the old footage.
I'd love to see
because
it.
He walks in on a card game in the Bronx. A bunch of guys in the back room of a deli playing cards. older guys, many Italian guys. He intimates that they're connected, and he asks them, so who do you think owns the Federal Reserve?
Owns the Fed? Yeah.
Not a single person at that poker table, all men over age 60, knew who owned the Federal Reserve. They all assumed the Federal Reserve was owned by the government. And people on the street, left and right, all through Times Square. And the last footage of the show, there's a guy, for lack of a better description, dressed like a bum. Older gentleman, hanging out on the street corner, watching these interviews from afar. And he walks up to the reporter and says, I know who owns the Federal Reserve. And the reporter says, who? And he starts rattling him off like he knew. I didn't plant him. I dig this footage up, you'll think for sure I planted this guy, I did not. He was a street person in New York City and the only one who knew who owned the Federal Reserve. And Mr. DeSalvatore went down to Wall Street and asked people in front of that famous bull and bear statue who owns the Federal Reserve. Stockbrokers, MBAs, PhDs, I'm sure in the crowd. Not one could identify the owners of the Federal Reserve. And it's no accident. They weren't taught about it in school. The Federal Reserve system, as they were taught, is part of the government. The Federal Reserve Board is appointed by the president. And this is what we're taught. We're not taught that the Federal Reserve banks are owned by the member banks that they regulate. Isn't that ironic? Imagine if the FDA was owned by drug companies and doctors.